Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
According to scientists, sea levels may rise 3 to 6 feet globally during the next century due to climate change. Millions of Americans live in coastal areas that would be flooded by sea level rises of these magnitudes. There is also concern regarding surges from destructive storms like Hurricane Sandy, which caused so much damage in October 2012, particularly in New York and New Jersey. Sandy was a superstorm of a type previously referred to as once in a century. Though looking ahead, some fear that such storms may become more frequent due to climate change and resulting extreme weather events.
How can our coastal communities deal proactively with the challenges of rising sea level and storm surges? Today we'll discuss this important topic with Jessica Granis of the Georgetown Climate Center, who is one of the authors of Sea Level Rise Toolkit. Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us first a little bit about the Georgetown Climate Center, what it is and what work is done there?
Sure. The Georgetown Climate Center is an institute on Georgetown University Law Campus. We were created to be an intermediary between the states and the federal government on climate policy. And we work on both mitigation, which is reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing global climate change, and adaptation, which is responding to the inevitable impacts of climate change. My work focuses mainly on helping state and local governments figure out how to adapt to rising seas and increased flood events like we've been seeing in Sandy and along our Gulf Coast.
How is the Climate Center funded?
We are funded primarily through private foundations. The Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund all contributed funding to create the center in the run-up to passing comprehensive climate legislation. And then our sea level rise work is primarily funded by the Kresge Foundation.
And you authored the Sea Level Rise Toolkit. Can you tell us a little more about it? What's in it? Who's it intended for? What motivated you to create this toolkit?
Sure. I came to the Climate Center from the state of California, where I was helping the California Ocean Protection Council develop their adaptation strategy for coasts and oceans. And then I came to the Georgetown Climate Center, and the inspiration was to look at this from a national perspective. So the Sea Level Rise Toolkit really is designed to provide the menu of options for state and local governments to think about how they can respond to and prepare for the impacts of sea level rise and increased precipitation. The strategy behind it was that there's not really any one-size-fits-all approach to adaptation because communities have diverse coastal landscapes and resources and development that's at risk. They're going to have to think about a range of land use tools that they can use to prepare for and respond to impacts. So we look at 18 different land use tools. And we really focused on existing tools that state and local governments can implement now with existing authority and looking at tools that don't require policymakers to reinvent the wheel. These are all standard land use tools that communities have applied in other places, sometimes to address other land use problems like flooding or sprawl, but that could be modified to respond to threats from sea level rise. So we look at planning tools like using comprehensive plans and transportation plans to think about where you're siting development and where you're siting public investments. We look at regulatory tools, so how are you permitting development in vulnerable areas, spending tools where governments investing in assets and services, and then some incentive-based tools like how are they using tax incentives to encourage wiser development decisions or acquiring vulnerable coastal lands. Those are the range of different tools that we discuss in the toolkit. And then finally, we provide a framework to help policymakers think about the trade-offs between different tools to figure out which tools will help their jurisdiction respond to its unique local concerns. So that looks at the environmental costs and benefits of a different option. So like armoring is something that gets talked about a lot, but it has some significant environmental impacts, and armoring can be very costly. So building a giant seawall might not be cost effective for a smaller size community. Then we look at some of the social trade-offs. How protective is an option and how robust is it given different ranges of sea level rise that people are projecting over the next century? Then we look at some of the legal and administrative questions. So can a local government implement the tool with existing authority? Are they subject to potential liability under constitutional takings law or tort liability? And some of the administrative challenges, some of these tools are easier to administer than others. So those are the range of questions that we help community answer in figuring out their strategy for adapting to sea level rise impacts.
And when you're engaging communities with the Sea Level Rise Toolkit, how are you presenting risk? Are you viewing the significant sea level rise as a certainty, as something that's likely and ought to be prepared for just in case? How do you present it to them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question because even the science on sea level rise is pretty uncertain. The next climate assessment is going to come out in the next month, and the projections for sea level rise over the next century range from anywhere between 0.2 meters to 2 meters. And when you're thinking about planning a bridge or planning investment decisions, that's a huge range, and that range is going to play out on the ground differently in different communities. So it's a challenging question, and it's something that planners grapple with on a day-to-day basis. We go into it, you know, just assuming, and I think a lot of the planners that we deal with know that this is a reality and something that they have to start to plan for. We benefit somewhat in the coastal sector from the fact that people are already beginning to see these impacts on the ground, and so it's less of a political question in the coastal zone than it is in other parts of the country. But generally, people are beginning to accept that this is the new normal and we need to start thinking about how we adapt to the impacts.
Can we learn anything from the damage done by Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast? Does your toolkit offer any advice that's especially salient for New York and New Jersey and what they've just experienced?
Yeah, the toolkit helps communities think about how they can deal with development and redevelopment. Land use is a tricky problem because the decisions that you make today in terms of permitting development are governed by processes that happened 10, 20 years ago in terms of the community's comprehensive plan and their zoning ordinance and whatever regulatory frameworks are in place. So you somewhat get locked into a pattern of development and redevelopment. But as horrible as disasters are, they do present a unique opportunity for communities to start thinking about how they catalyze the political attention to the issue and channel that into changing their ways of doing business on the ground. So one option, and what we've seen in a lot of communities that have responded to these types of disasters, is that after the disaster, there's a big political push to change those land use policies that govern where we're putting development and moving development out of harm's way. So that can be a political catalyst to move some policies that aren't politically feasible before the disaster. The other opportunity that arises is disaster relief funding becomes available from the federal government. And when we're in these times of cash-strapped state and local governments, that influx of cash can be hugely important to facilitate adaptation, particularly with some of the spending options. So a lot of communities use hazard mitigation money that comes from disaster relief to buy out vulnerable properties. So where you have properties that are repetitively flooding and they're in highly vulnerable parts of your coast, you can use that money to buy out those properties and restore the natural floodplain function, and that provides upland protection to the inland properties.
That's an interesting option. How does that kind of a buyout work? How do you set the price? Is the price based on what the condition is after the disaster, or what it was before, or what it might be?
No. So under the federal program, you have to pay fair market value for the property. So that is calculated at a pre-disaster rate. So they're paying kind of full value for the property. But the benefit is that a lot of these properties are covered by federally subsidized flood insurance. And so by buying out that property, you can limit the future liability of the flood insurance program to have to pay claims for those property owners. The other problem with the program is that it's not necessarily a problem, but a limitation is that the buyouts have to be voluntary. So the property owner has to raise their hand and say, I want to be bought out. You can't compel them to be bought out, which means that where you're trying to restore a natural floodplain and provide that natural flood protection, if you have one property owner who wants to be bought out and their neighbor, you know, does not, then you have this checkerboard effect where you have some properties that are bought out and others aren't, and so you can't restore that natural flood protection, and so you don't have as efficient use of the funds as you may otherwise have if you could get everyone to agree.
So eminent domain is not an option in a case like this?
It's not an option if you use these federal funds. It could be an option if you used a separate source of funding, but communities are really hesitant to use eminent domain just because of the political problem of condemning people that are perceived as victims of storm events. It's a tricky, tricky issue.
What's the role of flood insurance? What's the relevance of the 2012 Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Act? Will it provide assistance in dealing with sea level rise?
Well, to understand the reforms, it's necessary to take a step back and think about the problems with the National Flood Insurance Program before the reforms were enacted. And for adaptation, those problems are twofold. The first is when the program was started in the 1960s, we subsidized any properties that existed before the flood insurance program was enacted. These properties became grandfathered, and over the course of the program, they've enjoyed highly subsidized insurance rates on their flood insurance. And the Reform Act is going to phase out a lot of these subsidies. So if your house is a second home, or if you sell your property to a new owner, or it's severely damaged in a storm, those subsidies are going to gradually be phased out, which means that insurance rates are going to dramatically rise for a lot of coastal property owners, and the costs of insurance are going to more accurately reflect the true market risks of living in these vulnerable parts of the coast. And that's also going to help to make the flood insurance program more solvent. The flood insurance program is currently running about an $18 billion deficit, and that's not including any of the claims from Sandy, which is likely to push FEMA over their current cap of borrowing authority, which it's set at $21.8 billion. So by increasing those rates, we can at least start to make the flood insurance program more solvent for the long term. The second thing that the Reform Act changed was the flood mapping program. The flood insurance program all revolves around what are called flood insurance rate maps or FIRMs. FEMA develops flood insurance rate maps, and the rate maps designate the area that would be susceptible to flooding during a 100-year flood event, an area that has what's called the 1% flood. So these areas have a 1% chance of flooding in any given year based on historic flood data. But the problems with these firms is that they're all historic looking, and some of them are 20 years old, so they're not reflecting the most up-to-date information we have about flood risks. And they also govern where communities impose land use regulations. So in the 100-year floodplain, communities have to impose minimum floodplain regulations. Housing has to be elevated and anchored. And that's also where property owners have to buy insurance if they have any kind of mortgage. But because the mapping program is so out of date and because it's historic looking, it's not reflecting the current risks in these 100-year floodplain areas, and it's definitely not reflecting the future risks that we're likely to see with rising seas and increasing precipitation from climate change. So one of the things that the Reform Act did was it gave FEMA explicit authority to look at sea level rise on flood insurance rate maps. I don't think that this is going to affect the mandatory components of the program, so the insurance and the regulations are not going to be triggered in areas that are vulnerable to future sea level rise. They'll still be keyed to those historic 100-year floodplain areas, but it will at least give willing communities that want to work with FEMA to develop sea level rise maps the tools they need to think about how sea level rise is going to change their flood risk over time. And there's nothing in the flood insurance program that would prevent a local government, if they wanted to use those sea level rise maps for regulatory purposes. And that's one of the biggest challenges that local governments have now, is even if they want to regulate and they want to be precautionary, they don't really have the necessary mapping tools to know how and where to impose regulations.
So picking up on the issue of local regulation, I'm curious as to what kind of response you've gotten to this point on the toolkit that you've developed. As I understand the way you've described it, a lot of the policies are focused, or the policies are focused substantially on land use. And it seems that you're entangled with a lot of vested interests when you start talking about land use, particularly if you're saying in the future land use should be different than it is now. So what's been the reaction to the client group or the market group that you're targeting?
I mean, it's always a political issue when you're talking about land use. And I think that was the reason why we designed the toolkit to cover such a wide range of different options, because in communities where regulation isn't necessarily an option right now, they can think about how they spend money differently at a state or local level, or how they use incentives to encourage people to develop new development in a way that's more cognizant of the risks. But these regulatory tools, when you're talking about land use regulation, are becoming more of interest to folks because they're seeing these massive impacts along their coast. And I mean, local governments in particular are put between a rock and a hard place because they're responsible for emergency response and evacuating people and having their whole community shut down for weeks on end, like we saw in New York. But, you know, they also have these development pressures that they need to comply with. So, I mean, the tools really look at a range of different options. You can elevate structures. You can build them to be more flood-proofed and more resilient to impacts. And that might be the option that you need to employ in very densely developed places like New York City. And it also looks at armoring responses, which has been discussed a lot lately for New York and putting a storm surge barrier across the Verrazano Narrows. But in places where you have less densely developed, more rural areas like we have down here in Maryland, armoring's not going to be an option. So they really need to think about how to, you know, regulate land use so they're not putting new development in highly vulnerable areas, and making sure that any redeveloped structures are built to be more resilient to impacts or are gradually phased out over time and relocated out of vulnerable areas. So that's sort of where the design of the toolkit went, was to look at, you know, the range of different scenarios that local governments encounter and try to arm them with as many different options as we can to respond to that range of differences in the landscape.
So your discussion of the trade-off between armoring and, in effect, moving out of the zone of risk, if you will, or changing the activities in the zone of risk, sounds like your analysis is based on a kind of qualitative trade-off between costs and benefits. That is your differentiation between New York and what might be the areas in coastal Maryland. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I mean, that's one aspect of the question, is whether or not you have the tax base to justify the cost. I mean, a huge storm surge barrier is going to be massively, massively expensive. And if you don't have the financial wherewithal to build that, that's problematic. But you're also dealing with geographic problems. I mean, when you're on an open shoreline or a barrier island, armoring's not really an option. New York is situated in a bay such that they could armor in a way that would be cost-effective and would make sense. So there are different aspects, from engineering to cost to the environmental impacts, that people need to consider. I mean, you can't armor a sandy beach where you want to keep that sandy beach, because over time it'll erode. So you need to think about, if you're going to armor a sandy beach, do you also re-nourish so that you can maintain that sandy beach? And what are the impacts to the beach if you do armor the upland? And that's going to be a separate consideration for places that rely on their beach, like Virginia Beach or Ocean City, and these places that have a huge tourist-driven economy. And that's a whole different set of issues. In Miami, you have the situation where you can't armor because they have porous limestone, and so it's not feasible to armor there just because of the landscape. So it's a whole range of issues that you need to consider with the single armoring question.
And do you model any of your toolkit recommendations on foreign government responses to sea level rise problems? Are there any examples of foreign projects that you've taken any interest in?
Not really. The problem with foreign adaptation options is that the U.S. tends to be pretty unique in terms of how we regulate land use, especially in the coastal zone where you have this division between state, federal, and local authority. We have a pretty complicated mesh of overlapping and sometimes conflicting statutes and laws that govern what you can do in the coastal zone. And then we also uniquely have some pretty robust protections for private property that other communities don't have to address in terms of the legal integration challenges. So what works in another country isn't necessarily replicable in the U.S. and won't necessarily easily integrate into our legal framework. So we were really looking at kind of those existing tools where we knew there was clear authority for local governments to use these tools and implement them now, rather than kind of thinking about how they would reinvent the wheel or, you know, do things dramatically different.
So are there really good examples out there that you point to in the toolkit or that you can point to in this discussion of communities that are using some of these ideas with good results?
In terms of sea level rise or?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So from a regulatory perspective, there's a couple places that have implemented into their coastal management policies explicit reference to sea level rise. And so properties that are developed adjacent to the coast have to consider sea level rise in the design of the structure. The San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission just recently updated their coastal management program to require a development project to consider sea level rise. Maine has a similar requirement, as does Rhode Island. Most of these are relatively recent and they only affect new development or, you know, substantially redeveloped property. So they haven't been tested all that much. In Maryland, you have some, and in California, you have, in terms of spending powers, Maryland and California are thinking about sea level rise when they purchase and acquire coastal property for acquisition and preservation, which, you know, if we have a limited pot of money, we need to be thinking about how we're acquiring property and what types of property we want to acquire and preserve for natural floodplain function and ecosystem services. So those are a couple examples. I mean, I think because this is a relatively recent problem that we've just started grappling with, the first stage that state and local governments went through was really doing a vulnerability assessment to think about what their risks are and think about, you know, how they develop a adaptation strategy to grapple with what their response should be. And there's much fewer examples of implemented activities on the ground because that is a much harder road to hoe, whatever the saying is.
It would seem much more difficult to change existing land use than to kind of work at the margin where there's a change coming about, that's a proposal in place, which is imminent, yeah, and much easier to affect.
Yeah, I mean, but we have seen, I mean, in the floodplain context, we're hosting a webinar actually tomorrow where communities have really looked at how they build resilience to hazards. And even if it's not specifically directly in response to climate change vulnerabilities, there are good examples of communities that have put in place more robust floodplain regulations where they've extended their floodplain regulations to cover further inland areas, and they're increasing the design standards for structures that they do allow to be constructed in the floodplain, and they're limiting new subdivisions or requiring subdivisions to be clustered when they design in the floodplain. So there are examples where communities are building resilience. There are fewer examples where people are directly responding to projected sea level rise.
I think it's more difficult for people to address that, and a very difficult change to deal with. At the same time, it seems to be a change that's coming at us. We really appreciate your spending the time to talk to us about your work and the toolkit that you prepared, and we look forward to tracking what you're doing in the future. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.